You're listening to Orange County's only station with critical business information, Critical Mass, with Rick Franzi and Doug Geveller.
Hello, and welcome to Critical Mass, the radio show. This is your host, Rick Franzi, and it's great to be here on this installment. My business partner, Doug Geveller, and I co-host this business talk show, which airs Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, heard exclusively and live on octalkradio.net. And so for those of you in our listening audience that are listening to us live, hello. And for those of you that are listening to us in some future podcast, great to talk with you. You ought to listen live. It's a wonderful show, 4 to 5 p.m., octalkradio.net. Our goal for this show is to help business owners and top executives make better, more informed decisions. And we do that by interviewing executives who have what Doug and I term transferable knowledge and ideas. And our guest here in a moment, we'll be getting to Norman Wolf of Quantum Leaders in just a few minutes. He is definitely in that category of a person with transferable knowledge and ideas. I'm excited to have him as our guest today. You know, this radio show is truly an extension of our 16-year business practice, and we do that here in Orange County under the name Critical Mass for Business. We also offer CEO peer groups and partnership with Renaissance Executive Forums. Renaissance is an international business organization with over 1,200 members. And we're proud to be associated with them and have been for the past 16 years. Doug and I offer a truly differentiated experience for our members who are business owners and executives because our research shows that 80% of the issues and opportunities, frankly, the top executive faces are really common with those of other top executives who are leading similarly sized businesses. Recently, my book, Critical Mass, The 10 Explosive Powers of CEO Peer Groups, has been called a definitive guidebook to the CEO peer group experience. And if you're interested, is available for sale on Amazon.com. Just type in my full name, Richard Franzi, and you will see the link to the book. You can also find it by coming to our website, which is www.criticalmass4business. That's Critical Mass for Business. Well, as I said, we have a special privilege today. We have a business leader, a coach and consultant, as well as a pending author. We're going to be talking about many things with Norman Wolf today of Quantum Leaders, and certainly one of them will be his forthcoming book. But before we do that, let me welcome Norman to the show. Welcome to Critical Mass, the radio show.
Hi, Rick. Thanks a lot for having me on the show. I really look forward to it.
So do I. Norman, let's get right into the interview, my friend. Could you begin the conversation by talking to our audience about your background and your path to your current firm, Quantum Leaders?
I'd be happy to. So I started my career basically with Hewlett Packard. I started as a systems engineer and grew up through the ranks, leaving them in 1988. From the position of head of administrative operations for the Western Sales Region. So this was a small organization, only 1,300 people, 11 Western states, or 13 Western states and 11 branch offices. So I kind of cut my teeth in learning about management under the HP way, if you will. But since then, since 1988, I've actually been working with small and medium-sized companies predominantly as a consultant. Been doing a lot of different kinds of consulting from turnarounds to strategy, mergers and acquisition. Spent 6 years running a startup incubation, new product development. Worked in industries from technology to financial services, manufacturing, distribution, even worked with Bristol Farms as a client at one point in time. So a broad range of experiences. In 2002, I actually had a sense of starting a company, a consulting company, primarily because I began to recognize that the world after the dot-com bust was fundamentally changing. And I began to recognize that something new was needed for businesses in the 21st century, that the approaches businesses took during the 20th century, while still valid in many, many ways, was necessary but not necessarily sufficient. And some of the things, Rick, that brought about these changes, things like the frequency of change businesses were facing was accelerating. For instance, product life cycles. I remember when I was at HP during the 70s and 80s, we thought a product life cycle of 3 years was quite accelerated. I remember right. back in the late 90s and early 2000 when I started Quantum Leaders, product life cycles for laptops were like 6 months. Companies had to prepare end of life for the product before it was even introduced. So these factors, you also have the influx of the millennials who are looking for a different experience from business. You have the aging baby boomers. So much has been changing that the old ways of doing things were beginning to break down. I think, unfortunately, our financial collapse, 2008, really showed how quickly things can break down. So, bring about what you might call a new paradigm.
So let's go back a little bit to, you know, 19. I don't want to dwell on your time at HP, but that certainly, for a long time, was known as a great place to get trained in a mm-hmm. healthy culture and company.
Yep.
You said the HP way. I mean, books have been written about the culture of HP, and you know, when they had succession planning, some of the issues I think with, you know, some of the successors were they respecting the HP culture or not? Can you share with our listening audience from your perspective, and albeit you haven't been there, you know, since 1988, but what was your experience with the famed HP culture?
Well, you know, I haven't been there since 88, and there have been numerous changes since. But for me, watching HP, you know, I sort of have HP blood in my veins to some degree, and watching the changes it's gone through over the years has been a little painful, because the HP culture was one that, to me, was one of the few really balanced approaches to running an organization. They obviously believed in making a good profit, but they also believed in being innovative. One of the core principles of the HP ways was that we would contribute to the art of whatever field of endeavor we were in. So they didn't want to just make me two products. They definitely had a strong culture of developing people. It's probably where I really learned most of my theories, if you will. Most of my beliefs came out of what I found worked and didn't work. You know, my early career at HP, as my first year of management, was probably one of the toughest years for me because I failed miserably. But I had a lot of support, and I learned a lot of things. As they say, you learn mostly from your mistakes, and I certainly learned from mine.
Well, you know, Norm, that's one of the things that I think it's really important for, especially the younger people who are coming into the workforce. I think it's very beneficial for individuals who made a decision that they're going to go to work for a company rather than being an entrepreneur and starting their own business, to really seek out and work at companies that have a good culture and that are known to be a good place to work, whether it's Trader Joe's or HP or other companies like that. Because I think so much of what people learn, especially at a young age, about how to lead and how they don't like to be led and how they like to be led can be taught in a healthy organization. So for you to have the opportunity to work for the years that you did at HP, that's probably benefited so many of your clients who never had experience inside of HP, but you were able to bring the qualities that you learned from being an employee there to help those companies' culture, right?
Yeah, absolutely correct. And in fact, like I said, you'll find in the work I'm doing in the living organization model, which we'll get to a little bit later, the core of everything I do actually emanates. It's almost like taking the HP way to the next level. So clearly it's been so embedded in me that everything I do with clients has a piece of that in what I do. And I couldn't agree with you more. As a matter of fact, I almost would say, not almost, I emphatically say that if you don't have a culture like a Trader Joe's or an HP, you won't be successful in the 21st century. It's not just a nicety anymore. This is the part where it's beyond just a nicety. It's now a necessity.
I'm glad to hear you say that because I am, let me say that, as I see more and more companies, and frankly, as we do this radio show and get more exposure to varied businesses, et cetera, I marvel at companies that, as they grow, are able to maintain a positive, healthy culture because my sense in looking out over much of corporate America, large institutions, is it's a challenge to be able to maintain that healthy culture. And it's not always the large firms that struggle with it. It can be small and mid-sized companies too. But my sense is it accelerates because of the people factor in the larger companies. And so to hear you say you believe culture is important to companies' long-term success, I think that's true. And who does the culture, who does it rest with to define the culture but the leader and leaders of that organization, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the work I'm doing with Quantum Leaders and, in fact, the Living Organization Model explains in great detail why culture is important and explains how we've gotten to where we are and what it takes to go to the next step.
And I think I'm excited for your book to be published. I think it'll be a good read for people. I'm having gotten to know you over the times that we've, you know, gotten to know each other and understanding the content of your book. I think it's very timely. And I do think, given what we've just gone through with the last kind of economic hit and sort of what, you know, people are looking at the stock market here as this quarter ends going, what are we in for in the future? These are very challenging and uncertain times, and I'm sure the people that lived in the Roman Empire said these are the most complicated times we've ever lived in, but I think an honest appraisal of it looks and says, man, there's just so much more now for leaders, not only the speed with which things change, but the level of complexity that business leaders have to make decisions. It really is accelerating at an unheralded pace.
Absolutely is, and so, you know, the ways we used to do business in the past are no longer sufficient. They, you know, for instance, if you go back over time, the fundamental approach to business was what I would call the machine paradigm. You're optimizing a machine that is meant to produce goods and services. But the problem with that paradigm is it's a soulless, lifeless machine. And this machine is dominantly made up of people, and people are not soulless or lifeless. And, you know, sometimes I use the metaphor of an artist. My wife happens to be an artist. And the example I use is, imagine taking an artist who's creative, talented, and work to make them highly efficient. Well, in the process of going for efficiency, we've lost the soul of the artist. And the very thing that makes them great becomes ho-hum, and that's the piece that gets lost in the old paradigm. And if you're going to be successful, you got to go underneath the machine and recognize what makes the organization alive, and how do you as a leader manage that?
Yeah, that is that's a challenge, because, you know, much of what's being invested in corporate America, and I say corporate America because I'm most familiar with companies in the U.S., not internationally, is making for an efficient business. You know,
absolutely.
It is taking out waste. It is streamlining the decision making. It is putting in processes that make for repeatable and predictable performance. And I can see how that, to your point, while it may be important, it may have a unintended consequence, which is to attack something that's more vital.
With it. We've paid the price. You know, at HP, there was a time when there was a division review coming up, and there's a story that's told about how Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard were going through the division, and they noticed that the tool crib, the supply cabinet, had a lock on it. And they asked the division manager, how come there's a lock on it? And the division manager said, well, you know, we've been having a lot of losses from the tool crib. And Bill Hewlett, the story is told that Bill Hewlett went out and got a big cutter and cut the lock off of the thing. And he said to the division manager, you know, for the amount of dollars we'll lose in some supplies, isn't worth the locking out the creative talent of our engineers who want to work after hours, who want to have the freedom to experiment and explore. He said, you know, you're looking at the picture too narrowly. And I think with efficiency, with the push to efficiency, we've been looking at the picture way too narrowly.
And so a transferable learning moment is right now, Norman, and that is that for those listening in the audience today who are leaders of organizations, your actions are powerful and they may outlive you. The stories may be told of your actions after you are long gone from this earth. And so I just keep impressing upon leaders of companies and organizations of any size, the way you handle yourself and react to situations and what you consider important by your actions will be the stories told by your people and maybe future generations. And that story you just told is a great example of that, right?
Absolutely. And Rick, you hit on what I would call another transferable moment, and that is the notion of storytelling. We talk about a little while ago about the importance of culture. What we don't recognize is how to actually affect the cultures we have. And the key to that is the stories that are told. Culture is created out of stories. So the HP way, yeah, there's a list of statements about what the HP way is. Yes, there's a set of 9 objectives, at least it was when I was back there, that we lived by and values we had. But it was the stories like this that are repeated over and over again throughout. It's the story about Dave Packard coming back from Department of Assistant Secretary of Defense and kicking a trash can across the room and at the general manager's meeting and saying, gentlemen, now that I have your attention, I want to tell you I don't like the way you've been running my organization. And somebody said, Dave, but, you know, this is a management by objective. And Dave said, yes. And right now the ship is listing, so your objective is to take my direction. And when you when the ship is righted, we'll let you have more freedom in defining the objectives. It's stories like that that are told repeatedly within an organization. It's a story like one of my clients who speaks about the fact that they're an engineering test facility and they test components and systems for aerospace and defense. And the chief operating officer has been going around and saying, you know, we test through our labs over 80% of the components going into the new Boeing 787 Dreamliner. And what I want you to know is that when your friends and family or you're traveling on the new Boeing 787, you can rest assured that that plane will land safely because of the work you do here. That's a story. That's a story that enlivens the people and gives them a reason to work. That's what establishes the culture. That's what establishes purpose and meaning. And that's what's going to drive engagement. And we all know that engagement these days is one of the key things to success. This is the changes that are beginning to happen that leaders have to pay attention to.
So you know, we're talking kind of and setting a context for you as a business writer. You're going through the process, and those in our audience who have either written a book and had it published or in the process of writing a book can certainly empathize with the journey that you are on to bring your book, to make your book, a product that people can enjoy and learn from. Can you discuss with our audience kind of the messages contained within your forthcoming book and give us a little more context specifically for your book?
So the title of the book is Leading the Living Organization, The Science and Spirit of Creating Magical Results. At least that's the current working title. The purpose of it is, one, I recognized as I've said, that looking at an organization as a machine of production is just not good enough anymore. I also recognize there are some companies, you named one of them, Trader Joe's, I spoke about HP, we've got others, Walmart, Apple Computer with the iPhone, companies who somehow come along and create not just good to great results, but what I call magical results. And I began to realize that there's an old Arthur C. Clarke statement that goes something like advanced technology or significantly advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. But I also, you can reverse that and say underneath all magic is some scientific principles that we can rely on. And so I began to identify what those principles are that create, that take companies beyond good to great and create magical companies. And what I realized is that there's both a science to creating a living organization and a spirit to creating a living organization. So the science part is really predicated on everything is energy. And energy can't be created or destroyed. So really what business is doing is transforming energy from one form to another. And the source of that energy is the people in the organization. Their efforts is the only source of energy that an organization really has. And the business processes that we spend so much time optimizing is really nothing more than an energy waveguide directing and organizing and orchestrating that flow of energy. So it's directed like a laser beam towards the results. And that's the fundamental part of the, that's what business is really doing. The financial system is designed as a gauge for the system. Every engineer will tell you a system needs a feedback loop. And our financial system is fundamentally that feedback loop. The revenues part of the profit equation really is a measure of how much value the marketplace puts on the products and services they buy. And the value is not only defined by the product and service itself, but the experience. So you take a Starbucks, for example. Starbucks sells the same coffee as 7-Eleven or AM/PM, but they get a whole lot more money. So the product is the same, although I give Starbucks aficionados the benefit by saying, yes, some of them think the product's actually better. Fundamentally, the product at a cost of goods sold basis is about the same. So what's the difference? Well, it's the experience you get from going to Starbucks. And so experience demands a higher value. Trader Joe's is all about the experience. Nordstrom's all about the experience. Whole Foods, same thing. Time and time again, even at HP, customer experience was a key component. So revenue has to do with the measure of value. Value is both the product and the experience combined. Expenses is nothing more than a measure of the efficient use of energy. How much energy are you wasting in the system? So profit, the financial system, is really a gauge, a feedback loop on the system. What's happened in our society is we made the financial goal the reason for existing, the reason for a company to be in business, and it really never was meant to be that way. If you go back to the 1800s and 1900s, even in the early 1950s, companies were formed to be in service to society, and it's really only since the last 20, 30 years, 1980, 1970 timeframe, that the financial markets took over, and the companies became a means to the end of the financial markets, return on investment, as opposed to the financial markets being a means, a resource to allow companies to achieve their goal of being in service to society. So the basic flow of energy, what we're really doing is managing energy, and a lot of the laws of energy can be applied to how we manage businesses. That's sort of the science of it. The other piece to that was there's actually three fields of energy flowing through an organization. You know, if you look at white light, you pass it through a prism, you see the different frequencies, the different colors, but there are different colored frequencies. And in the book, I describe activity, relationship, and context. Activity is what we do and how we do it. It's what we have been managing for most of the last 100 years is just activity. What we do, what we sell, how we sell it, how we produce it, how we manufacture it. It's the traditional Frederick Taylor scientific management, go for efficiency, optimization. Relationship actually became part of the management language system around the middle of the last century, with things like teamwork and collaboration and, you know, who we do it with, the synergy of the of a team, high-performing teams. All of this is all around relationships, branding, our image out there, our customer relations management, supply chain management. All of this has to do with the relationship field. The third field is what I consider the emerging field, and I call it context because it's the field that gives meaning and purpose to what we do. And we talked a lot about that a little while ago in terms of the culture setting component of an organization. That's the context field. The importance, Rick, is to recognize that these three fields of energy are energy, and you can actually manage them. For the most part, most leaders never think about managing the cultural aspect of the organization as something they can do, that they can actually take some actions on it. We talked about one of them, the storytelling aspect. So that's the first part of the book, what I call the science of business. The second part of the book is the spirit of business. We all know, you know, the we call it, talk about esprit de corps or the team spirit. Well, organizations are, in fact, living entities. They're like a human body. They have the cells of the body are living entities. Like-minded cells join and form the organs of the body, and the organs collectively, the tissues, the bone structure, all of that forms the human body. You can call that the physiology. Well, organizations are structured the same way. The cells are the people, the individuals of the organization. Like-minded people form together and form departments. You know, you don't want an accounting person to be a salesperson, usually. So you have like-minded cells, like-minded individuals forming their particular functional departments collectively with the flow of information and the structure. You've got a corporate body. More importantly, that describes the physiology of the corporation. Corporations have a soul, a spirit. You really see this a lot in nonprofits or in entrepreneurial startups. You know, people go to work for nonprofits not because they're going to get an incentive-based pay. They go because they feel an identity to the mission, the purpose of that organization. Entrepreneurs collect, attract people to them because of the power of what they're trying to do. People work in the early days of startup companies for nothing, because not because they got nothing else to do, not even because they see the promise at the end of the day, because there's no guarantee that promise is going to happen. They do it for the passion of what they do. And so a living organization, an organization as a living entity, comes alive. It transcends the machine orientation. And once we begin to recognize it's a living entity, we also begin to have access to a whole different range of how we lead it. We can apply the same approaches that doctors apply to our bodies. We can apply the same approaches that sociologists and psychologists who have studied group dynamics and individual development, we can apply those same theories to the living organization. So that's in essence what the book is about. It starts off with the science, starts off by explaining the history, how we got to where we are, talks about the science, and then talks about the living, the spirit of the organization and an organization as a living entity with a soul and a purpose.
I'd like to react to a couple of the things you said and kind of
have a
dialogue back and forth about a couple of those things. I found it interesting early on when you said that the financial system and reporting can really be kind of a feedback loop on the performance of the organization, but it really has morphed into kind of the reason for the organizations to exist, especially for public corporations who have stockholders and investors and people who are really wanting it to return on their investment. So I found that interesting and something for our listening audience to kind of sit back. And I guess what you're cautioning as well, Norman, is that as the leader of a company or a firm, you really need to be thinking about what is your reason for existence.
Absolutely. That is so much more important in today's world. And you see it all over the place. People, I mean, think about how many companies you would join if all you knew about was that they had to go from $50 million to $100 million. I mean, how exciting is that? But if you knew your company was going to, as Google did, make information available to everyone, make the world's information available to everyone. Now, if that was something you had an interest in, you would definitely sign up, as did Google. Every company really starts because they have what I call a soulful purpose. And that's more critical to alignment and attraction than anything else we can do.
You know, many of the people in our listening audience are involved not only with their companies that they lead, but with nonprofit organizations, mm-hmm. either because they're on the board or in some way they give their time or their resources, finances to help that nonprofit. And it was interesting, Norman, that you brought up, mission-based organizations. Many of them are nonprofit, where people freely give of their time and effort because they believe in what the nonprofit stands for and how it's making a difference in the world.
Absolutely.
And so these same people who know that from their personal interests in their nonprofit, their giving, sometimes don't seem to bring it back to their day job, if you will, you know, to the organizations that they lead as a way that, how do I learn a lesson from that organization and inspire, you know, people within my organization? And you can inspire not only your employees, but I'm sure it's your experience. A company with a culture like that and a vision and a mission can inspire their suppliers, can inspire their clients. I mean, it's not just to do with your workers and your employees. It's your whole community of people associated with your firm.
Absolutely. I give a talk. I title it Eliminate Customers to Build Revenue, to Increase Your Revenue. And the premise of the talk, the underlying premise of the talk is we treat customers like objectified, disenfranchised, things, right? They're not people. They're just a collection of individuals we sell to. But I love the story Doug Rao tells from Trader Joe's. He's the former CEO, and I had an opportunity to spend some time with him recently. And he speaks of the Trader Joe's community. He doesn't look at them as customers. He looks as being part of a community. And he tells one story that I love about how a cashier helped out a young woman who had two kind of screaming kids and left her wallet at home. And he says, don't worry, you know, I'll pay for it. I'll take the cash out of my pocket. I'll pay for it. When you come back, pay me back. This woman went on what is called the Friends of Trader Joe's, I think it's called, website, which is a community bulletin board of people, not run by Trader Joe's, by the way. It's a community bulletin board that somebody else started. And she posted it on that website, how wonderful Trader Joe's is. And the community came to Trader Joe's defense. They said, oh, my God, we got to protect them. We don't want anybody knowing this because they might go in and take advantage of Trader Joe's. How many clients protect their suppliers? How many clients protect, you know, the companies they buy from? And that's a community. Communities are there. People in the community. Trader Joe's is just one member of the community. They're there to serve the rest of the community. And because of that service attitude, the community pays them back. Now, that's a way to build revenue in the 21st century, in my opinion.
I agree. And that gives me goosebumps hearing that story, because I think it's possible to have that type of a relationship with your clients, regardless of your industry,
absolutely,
regardless of what you do. It is not dependent on a B2C model or anything like that. It's really dependent on from within you and how your firm is seen and how you show up, if you
absolutely
will, in the marketplace.
And Doug said, you know, he said, Norman, we don't have a training manual. I would never have even thought to put something like that in the training manual. It comes out of the fact that our core culture, the context, the stories we tell, the things people believe that sign up here, it just becomes part of their individual DNA, and they just act that way naturally. Now, that's powerful.
That is, you know, and so much money, in my opinion, gets wasted in corporate America and in business trying to create something that doesn't exist naturally.
Absolutely.
And I think that's
you hit on the key aspect of why I call it the living organization. It's a natural response to life when people individually and collectively are doing something they believe in. It's a natural response. I may be unique, but I have an inherent belief that people are inherently good and really want to contribute. I believe people have three things they really care about. They want to contribute, to be in service. They want to learn and grow and develop as a human being, and they want to belong to something. We're social animals. We like to belong to a tribe. Corporations have been the community most of us have identified with for years. I spent 15 years at Hewlett Packard. I still feel like I'm an HP alumni. You know, I'm part of that community. It's been part of my life. It's a defining moment. How many business leaders out there can say that about their companies and their employees? I hope a lot.
Me too, and that's why I say you have to celebrate large companies who have a large impact on a segment of the workforce and have a good culture, because they're creating many people who embody the good things about what the leaders and founders have put into the culture. You know, you use the term living organization. So, Norman, I have to ask you, is there also a lifespan, or is there a growth chart of companies as living organizations?
Yeah, I do believe so. Part of one of the fundamental ways we approach our clients, which I think is distinct from how other consultants work with clients, because an organization is living, organizations go through developmental life cycles. Just like as a human, we're different at 20 than we were at 12, and we're different at 40 than we were at 20. And we're different at 60, happy to say, than I was at 40. And each one increases different stages of maturity, but there's also the transformational phase that an organization has to go through. Recognizing these energetics have to happen, and what I mean by energetic, when a person goes through a major transition or a life cycle change, it's important to honor and respect those change periods. Now, in history, back in the old days, before we became a modernized society, there were things called life cycle initiatives. So when a child was 13, they would go through some sort of a initiation, leaving the childhood and becoming an adult, right?
Right.
Marriage ceremonies were initiatory processes, not just big parties, because two people were really giving up at some level a sense of just me and becoming a we. And these were honored and celebrated. We don't do that anymore in society. But organizations, when you look at them as living entities, they go through the same thing. Ishak Adizes writes the book, The Life Cycle, and he talks about different phases of an organization. It goes from the startup or the go-go days to mature to adolescent to mature companies. And he's got like 10 different life cycles. I break it down into four, the startup phase, the entrepreneurial phase, the growth phase, and the mature phase. Each of these phases requires significant transformational periods. So, yes, we can look at companies as having life cycles, but they don't have to die. They just have to constantly be reborn. And so you take companies like Royal Dutch Shell, who's been here for like hundreds of years, or HP, who's been through, I don't know, dozens of life cycle changes. They can continue on as long as they keep growing evolving, developing. When a company stops evolving, they're basically on the path to death. And that's what happened to General Motors, most of the auto industry, et cetera.
Well, you know, Norman, you're talking about companies, but if someone had just tuned into the show and heard you discussing that, they could think you're talking about people, right? Because as people age, if they continue to kind of reinvent themselves and keep a curiosity and learn, share, and grow and constant. I was listening to a news report about the oldest postal worker who just retired. He was 90-some years old, and he had worked there 37 years, which means, you know, you do the math. He started in his late 50s, maybe 60 years old, to work at the post office, and he was working up until that day, and now he's gone off to, in his retirement, to tour the world and see different parts of the world that he hasn't seen yet. Now, who would think that, you know, someone in their mid-90s would have such a rich life? But that could be a company if it has the right approach to the market and to their people and to their culture. I just see a lot of parallels between what you talk about in a living organization and a living person.
And that's why I call it the living organization, because the parallels are so strong. And I see them over and over again. I was working with a group of, I was giving a presentation to a group of CEOs, and one woman was talking about selling her company, and she was having trouble finding or attracting the right buyers. And I said, why don't you stop thinking of your company as a company and think of it as your child, and you're looking for somebody to marry your child. And the energy within her and the shift in her thinking, you can almost feel in the room how powerful just that change in images. And she got some whole new ideas of who to approach and why and how to present the company. And it was no longer just a set of financial statements and a balance sheet and a customer list. This was her child. And she actually began to relate to it as her child. So you're right. And I think, I'm hoping that the power of the book changes the framework. You know, you talked about CEOs, executives out there who volunteer on nonprofits. A lot of what I'm saying has been out there in the world for a long time. But what hasn't happened is a change in the fundamental framework of how we view business. And just as companies have cultures and cultures define what we do and how we do it and why we do it, for good or bad, society has a certain culture around what business is about. So the very same people who go to a nonprofit walk into a business environment, and all of a sudden the thought about how to approach it, what we do here, how we do it, is defined by the societal culture about what business is all about, which is dominantly a machine of production. And so what I'm hoping to accomplish with the book is to change that and say, no, it's not a machine of production. It's a living entity, and start treating it like one and create a healthy lifestyle. And the cells within the body, i.e. the people, will also become healthy, and our society will be healthy. And that's what I'm hoping happens.
So how long have you been planning to write this book, and how much time and energy has it taken from you over the years to get to the point that you're at right now, Norman?
So I started the idea back in 2007, and it's gone through probably 3 or 4. Well, I'm calling this book 3, but there was actually a pre-book that it was called The Soul of the Corporation that started the process. And each phase of it, the concepts have come forward, been refined. Every time I talk about it, it was refined and fleshed out. So it's been a good 3-plus years that I've been actively working, consistently working on this book. And right now it looks like I finally got it to where it's ready to be published. The target date for publishing is this fall. And I've been just learning as I go, and it's as a friend of mine who just said, who just recently got published, said if he knew how much work it was before he started, he may never have started. But I can tell you also that the experience has been absolutely wonderful. I have found what I would consider my soulful purpose, my passion, what engages me, and it's almost become like a calling now. No, I'd rephrase that. It has become a calling of mine.
That's exciting, because when people start to read your book and react to it and talk about your content in a way that reaches them on a deeper level, that too begins, I think, to be the payback for the 3 years of your time that you've given to bring the book to life.
Absolutely.
And how, if someone wants to learn more about Norman Wolfe and Quantum Leaders and the book, where would they go and how should they do that, Norman?
Well, that's pretty easy. It's www.quantumleaders.com. And I have a blog called quantumleadersblog.com. I also post on Fast Company blog as an expert blogger. And they can contact me at on my cell phone, 949-689-2158. Again, 949-689-2158.
And I would love to have you back post-publishing of the book, and we can talk about how that went and get into the book in more detail, because we'll actually have it to thumb through, at least on my end. So Norman Wolfe of Quantum Leaders, you've got an open invitation to come back to Critical Mass, the radio show, after the book is published. And I do appreciate the time you spent with us here today on this show.
Thank you, Rick. I look forward to coming back, and I really appreciate you giving me this opportunity to share The Living Organization and Quantum Leaders.
I love it. I can't wait to read the book firsthand when it's published. Thanks, Norman.
Take care.
Goodbye. Norman Wolfe of Quantum Leaders and a soon-to-be-published author. I'm excited for him. I know how deeply he is invested in this book and the concepts behind it, and look forward to the read that I get of it when it comes out. So we'll bring him back on Critical Mass, the radio show, for our listening audience to learn even more about it after the book becomes published, because I'm sure on his journey to getting it into the print, there's still some things he's going to learn, and I'd like to hear about those as well. So that is what we do on this show here, Critical Mass, the radio show heard exclusively live on octalkradio.net every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m., and I look forward to our future shows. We just have such a staggering list of future guests in July and August that you will want to be reading our weekly newsletters telling you who our guests are, because trust me, ladies and gentlemen, there's a lot of new ideas and information contained in those future interviews. And if you haven't listened to some of the archives, check out our archives. You may find a peer business owner or executive that you know that you'd like to listen to her interview or his interview, or go on Apple iTunes and check the whole catalog and see if there's something there that you would enjoy kind of listening to. This is Rick Franzi, one of your co-hosts for Critical Mass, the radio show, saying I've enjoyed my time with you today in interviewing Norman Wolfe of Quantum Leaders, and here's hoping that all your business decisions are moving your business in a positive direction.
You've been listening to Critical Mass, only on octalkradio.net.